This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
I would like to welcome five-time PGA Tour winner and Ryder Cup member, and he's played in a few U.S. Opens, Mr. Ken Green, back to the Sub 70 podcast. Ken, it's great to have you here today to talk about the U.S. Open.
What's up, Jason? I got to believe we can find a subject or two to discuss.
I think there's a few from this week, so I'll just start off from like 10,000 feet, and then I'll start narrowing it down from there. But just give me your overall general thoughts of what you saw this week and your kind of overall synopsis of the tournament.
Well, I am stunned that everywhere in the world, when you continually screw up, you get fired. The USGA has made error after error after error. And they give you this little, we're just trying to find the best player for the week, or it's the same course for everybody. And it's like, I mean, it's just, it's sad. I wish I had, Jeff Bezos or the Amazon guy?
Yep.
I wish I had his money, because I would bury the USGA and put them out of business, because they don't do enough to grow the game of golf. Their main focus is to run these jobs, these tournaments, and they can't even do that right, and yet nothing happens. I don't get it.
Did you play in the 86 Open there?
Yeah, and you know, it's, you know, I hate to keep talking about, well, in my day, you know, the grumpy old man thing, but every U.S. Open was like that in the 80s. I mean, they tortured us. I mean, it was insane. And imagine Shinnecock when on Saturday and Thursday when the wind and the greens got bumpy, and then add spike marks to it. You want to talk about the fear of God? I mean, it just beat you up. I mean, there's no other way around it.
So even back 30 years ago, it was still it's no more difficult than what you saw, though, you know. For example, Saturday afternoon, you guys played under those conditions, and that was just the norm, what you're saying.
They got the green. You gotta remember, they didn't have those machines where they could just stick a little poke in the green and see what the temperature is. So they were winging it. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I played Augusta or any of these U.S. Open courses where the greens are turning blue. You know,
I've never seen that. It's got to be crazy.
They would just sit there and give us this smirky answer, and inside they go have their beers and laugh, because they knew exactly what they're doing. Don't that they don't know what they're doing. They know that they're trying to push it and go to the edge, because they're trying to create the Phil Mickelson breakdowns.
Let me ask you this. So you played in a number of U.S. Opens, obviously. How did you prepare for a week like that? What was sort of your mental approach going into something that difficult? If you can kind of walk us through it.
You know, obviously, you know, the first couple of years, you know, you have no clue that this is what it's about to be, because you assume that they're going to be like a little harder than most tour events, but you have no idea, you know, how hard they're going to set it up. And then after that, it's just a question of trying to make sure that you didn't fall into that trap of losing your emotions. And you know, in my case, because I was so aggressive and, you know, foolishly so, you know, I got destroyed by major U.S. Opens and, you know, Augustas when they got those greens turning blue. And, you know, I'm thinking I can hit my 5-iron in there, you know, a tap in range. But it's you have to, you know, Nicklaus has it best. I mean, there's a reason that he's the best. He was able to push the USGA aside and just say, you know, I'm literally going for the best part of the green every time. And he didn't care if he had a wedge in his hand. you know, he would not go for the pin unless he honestly thought he could have a chance to get it close. And you know, in U.S. Opens, you didn't have to. You know, anywhere from 5 under to 5 over was going to be good, depending on basically the weather.
Has to be a different mindset for you guys to go out there and, like I said, see a pin that's completely normally within range, and then a good golf shot is 36 feet away below the hole with the right angle. I mean, it has to be such a different way of playing golf.
It's got to be even harder for, you know, there might have been 10 of me's back in the days that we were dumb and going at all the pins thinking we were, you know, God's gift to the planet. You know, today they all play golf like this. This is how golf is now. You swing as hard as you can and you go and you attack everything. So it's got to be even trickier. But, you know, for whatever reason, some people just seem to have that mindset. I mean, you know, take Brooks, for instance. I mean, and, you know, he's still young, so I'm not going to beat him up, as some people might interpret this. You know, he's won 3 times and 2 of them have been opens. So it's like, well, why is Brooks' mindset so much stronger in a U.S. Open than it is other tour events? I mean, the guy has massive talent, so why isn't he winning more? You know, does he fall asleep or what? You know, maybe this will spur him on, and that's what I mean by I want to judge a person after their career is over, not like during it. But it takes a certain kind of mentality, you know, aka a Curtis Strange or a Jack or, you know, Tiger, you know, obviously it's just look at their personalities. You know, Ernie Els won twice, Retief Goosen. These are all very laid back, calm, kind of blah guys, if that makes any sense. And maybe you need that, you know, because you have to, you can't just turn it back 2 degrees when you play a U.S. Open. You got to turn it back 5 degrees. So even though I may have thought I was doing something, or other guys may have thought, they're not even coming close to doing enough. You know, look at Phil. I mean, you know, Phil's a perfect example. He gets caught every once in a while. He has these meltdowns, you know, whether it's, you know, this one or you know, the wing foot meltdown that he had there at the end. And it's one of those mysteries. I don't know if we'll ever really understand what it really takes to be able to be of that mindset that you can literally contend in a lot of U.S. Opens.
From a player's, I'm going to ask you another player's question. So you work your ass off Thursday and Friday to get in contention. You see the guys early on Saturday have some nice moves. The course is gettable. And then by the time you tee off, you're hearing and seeing Zach Johnson talking about the golf course is lost. First off, have you ever been in a situation like that where actually by playing good or really well the first 2 days kind of came back to bite you in the end, meaning that the conditions had changed so much? I know that's probably rare because they always try to keep the golf course fair for the day, which they should, but A, have you ever been through something like that? And then B, if you were in that situation, what would you tell yourself or how would you work yourself through that it's literally not fair and you're not seeing the same golf course the other competitors saw
right
earlier in the day, and now you're at a disadvantage for playing well?
Yeah, absolutely. No, you know, you're dead on. Those guys that teed off Saturday were literally bone porked, and it has happened, and it's going to happen again because the USGA doesn't use their brains. You know, at courses like Shinnecock, where you know unexpected winds can come up. It happened at Pebble Beach in '92. You know, when everyone thought Colin Montgomery had won the tournament because he went out, played a good early Sunday round, and then 40-mile-hour winds came up out of nowhere. And, you know, Tom Kite barely beat him. And, you know, and it was kind of AKA Tommy Fleetwood. But it's the common denominator is the location. So, you know, they don't lose them at, say, an Oakmont, if I have those wins. But, you know, they may already be unplayable, but it's unplayable even when you really tee off. You can't tee off, you know, seventh out of the box on Sunday and make up ground because the course is still playing so damn hard. Whereas, like at Shinnecock, they could because it's set up so easy. And it's like, what's so hard about Friday afternoon, knowing where you're going to put the pin on Saturday, going out and putting and chipping to those pins. And you'll be able to tell right then how much the course has changed in the afternoon. And you'll be able to say, oh, my God, we can't put this pin here on 13. We can't put this pin here on 14. We can't put this pin here on 15. You know, and yet, you know, all they do is, we might have made an error there. That was our bad. And, you know, and then everyone says, well, it's the same for everybody. But it's not, because you don't know when you hit that perfect shot, you don't know when you're going to hit it, or that bunker shot. I think that, well, even a couple guys did that, you know, they're literally putting it off the green. I mean, it's inexcusable to have a pin that close to an area where it could literally go down and off the green. I mean,
did you ever experience that in your career where you saw a course? I mean, does anything ever pop into your mind where you're like, holy cow, I'm screwed because I'm second to the last group on Saturday or Sunday? Do you ever recall a course changing that much where you were at a disadvantage?
The only time it happened to me was at the British Open, and it's a little different than a U.S. Open, because you know that the weather goes haywire there, and you know right. The greens at the British are slower. But I think I had shot 67, and I was second after one round, and it was a perfect day Friday morning. You know, I'd tee off at like 1:30 or 2 o'clock, whatever it was. And all of a sudden, this gale comes up out of nowhere for, you know, the whole afternoon. You know, I played what I thought was a great round of golf, 78, and I'm out of the tournament. You know, and Muirfield played so hard. It was, you know, but that's more about
like you
weather
can't control it. Right. And then also, too, I mean, I'm thinking about this. Wasn't Nick Price brought into the USGA for this reason, to help with this kind of stuff as a player's point of view? Like you said, how hard – this is the part I'm baffled on, like – it doesn't take a rocket scientist, right?
I don't get it.
Nicky Price put some balls and chip it as a quote-unquote as a pro,
yeah.
And go, you can't do that. It's already getting that firm when you put some water on this. I mean, you wouldn't...
Well, that's the thing I don't see. They're doing all their testing in the early morning, though, when they go out and set these pins and determine them. You know, they do these little putts and chips, and that you can't do that. So you got to wait literally until Friday when the last group is done. You know, when they make the turn... On both sides, someone should be out there chipping and putting to tomorrow's pins to see if this is doable or not. And you never see him doing it. And it's just common sense. Ken Green is not an idiot. I mean, a genius. He's more of an idiot than a genius. And they continually make the error. You know, we all screw up. You know, if you make one error, okay, we screwed up. Or, you know. But when they continually make error after error, you got to wonder... Do they really care? That's what I mean by I don't necessarily believe them that when they even apologize. I this is what they've done forever. You know, goes back to the massacre at Wingfoot, and you know, they just got basically embarrassed at Chambers Bay and Erin Hills with the way under score. And you know, Shinnecock is obviously, you know, I don't know what the I can't remember what Floyd shot when he won in 86, but I mean, I think it's been over par, over par, over par, and then whatever Floyd shot. I mean, so we all know how hard it's going to play, so why did you even bother? So then they turn around and they go and set it up on Sunday like it's a regular event. And,
well,
you know, you literally played four different golf courses.
Right, you knew that one was coming on Sunday.
Yeah, and that's...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Brooks played great, and everyone says, well, he played the best. But, you know, we never know, really, because it wasn't – it's not hard to set up a golf course fair but hard. And that's all the players are asking for, is just be consistent, not be unfair. And you know, they, for the first time, found out what the USGA can do at times. And, you know – you know, what are you going to do next week, next year when they go to Pebble?
Well, interesting topic. So that's on my list. So my question is, I've played there, and it can, I mean, the conditions can change, you know, three times in one round. The golf course isn't long. So, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. I mean, I'm thinking you could narrow it and stuff, but they hit, you know, I was just at a web.com event doing some media stuff in our area, and golf course plays 7,400 yards, but it narrows, and they're hitting driving irons 280 yards with it kind of fast and firm that week. The conditions allowed for it. So the problem they're going to have is to defend the golf course, you're going to have to trick it up, right? Because otherwise these guys will, it'll look like the AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Am. But then how do you not go over that line again where you get, lack of a better word, carnival golf? Because it's not going to, you know, driver's going to be taken out of their hand if you make it fast and firm. So I'm trying to picture in my head, how do you, I mean, do you let them just shoot 10 under par and say that's fine, that's what we're going to accept? Or how do you do it? How do you set that golf course up for next
year? Pebble's only defense is the weather and getting those greens like rocks. And if they get them like rocks and wind comes, they're absolutely screwed. So now, you know, like my opinion, if Ken Green is setting up you a Shinnecock, I would literally have had different fairways caught at different heights. I would have had different greens caught at different heights. And I will tell the players, this is what we're doing. You know, this might allow us more pins. You know, Shinnecock, when it was designed, you know, believe it or not, on those slopes, you could use those pins back then. But they were hard curlers. But, you know, greens were, I don't know, they might have been lucky if they were six in 1920. You know, so why not pull back the speed on some greens? But they have this mindset that we have to cut them all the same. We have to have the fairways the same. I would literally have some fairways a little softer to try to tease guys into hitting driver, have some firmer, and do the same with the greens. And then the guys who decide to play the golf course a certain way versus another player can either be rewarded or not. Because otherwise, you know, Pebble has very small greens. So what can you do?
Yeah, I'm like I said, it's going to be really interesting to see what they do after this, because like I said, I think there's going to be no middle ground. I think it's going to be hard for them to quote unquote get it where exactly they want it, where it's either going to be soft and some guys are going to go really low, and or it's going to be basically unplayable, because like I said, it's not a long golf course. I mean, especially for those guys. So yeah, and then this brings back my next question to you. Do they have to stop using these quote-unquote classic golf courses for the reason you just stated? The slopes in these greens, when they were built, no one dreamed the green speeds would get up to where they're at.
Right.
Do you have to start using modern golf courses? And just, I wrote in my notes here, like Hazeltine, like what they use for the PGA. Now, of course, Hazeltine's not nearly as good as Shinnecock or Pebble Beach, but it's a, you know, it's a big parkland golf course. You've got some room. You can make it long. Do you then just set it up kind of like a PGA and let them shoot anywhere from 8 to 12 under and call it an afternoon so it's a fairer test, and stop trying to take these golden age golf courses that were never designed to be played with this yardage, with these green sides of the slope, and try to somehow, well, quote-unquote, hold it to a line, which isn't going to work?
It's either that or, like I was saying before, they're going to have to make the decision that we're just going to have to not cut the greens so low. And I don't know if the USGA would do that. I mean, you know, at Pebble, you could put the driver in the trunk. You don't need driver, period. The course just isn't very long, you know, and they, you know, there's no real room. So unless they come up with, which I think is something for the future, is portable tees where they just use them for that week to force the guys to hit driver. You know, I think their only choice is listen, guys, we're not cutting it. You know, holes like 11 at Pebble or 4 at Pebble, we have to cut higher, or we can only use two spots on the green. Right. I mean, those greens are tiny there. I mean, I don't think the average golfer understands how small those greens are there. I mean, those are tiny puppies. And if you get those things like rocks, I played it, you know, the 92 Open, and I literally remember watching my ball bounce 30 feet in the air on the first hop on the 15th hole after hitting a 7-iron. And I was like, oh, I am way out of, I mean, I have no chance here. I'm just doomed. Now, they hit it much higher, and they get more spin now because of the velocity of their swings. But again, if you get it too hard, you're making it unfair. So It's just a question of whether the USGA can sit down and pull back their mindset and say, this is what we have to do. Guys will be fine with it. You don't see them bitching at the British Open when those greens are only putting to 10s because, you know, they can't have many faster because if they get those windstorms, the balls will roll off the green. And you don't hear any players saying.
Yeah, they get it. And the people, and I think the players, well, I don't want to speak for players, I'll let you comment on this, but they understand that the weather can come in, but the RNA seems to have a pretty good handle of setting up the golf course for these different conditions that you can get, right? You just don't hear the player feedback of an open championship. And if you do get the bad break, you realize it wasn't something the RNA did. It's just right. The nature of that tournament.
Yeah, there's not one player that will ever moan and groan about the weather, because it is what it is. You can't control that. But, you know, I mean, look at what Stenson and Mickelson did, I don't know, it was like 2 or 3 years ago, you know, with that classic battle they had.
Fantastic.
I mean, no one says, oh, geez, you know, that Troon was no good because, you know, the greens were only 10. You know, one guy shot 63, one guy shot 65 the last day. It was a great British Open. So why don't they learn? You know, I know that's not golf America, but if they're going to go to those venues, if you're going to use Shinnecock and you're going to use Pebble and maybe Bethpage to some extent, you're going to have to say, we can't cut these greens that fast. I mean, we just can't do it. You know, now here's another issue that comes in play. Wingfoot in 2 years. Well, do you think the grounds crew, the members of Wingfoot, are gonna say we want our course beat up? So, you know, they're gonna get those greens as hard as they can. You know, and you know, it's just we're opening up a door to something that could turn into an absolute, you know, a cluster puck, and we don't. That's just not what golf's about. People are okay with watching guys get beat up, but you still want it to be exciting. You know, whereas, you know, Shinnecock was more about, you know, the Saturday was, you know, a joke, and then, you know, Sunday turns into, oh my God, the greens are holding, you know, and they're nowhere near as fast. And, you know, why not make players think? Nothing wrong with having, you know, four fairways running at this speed and four at this speed and four at another speed. Then players have to think even more when you do that to the fairways and the greens.
The other thing I'm thinking of is, you know, they're trying to grow the game, and I'm sure somebody tuned in Saturday afternoon to watch that or whatnot. It's a major. It's supposed to be fun. They go, really? This looks like a disaster. Like, I don't know if I want to, you know, go spend some money on some clubs and play a quick nine after seeing. I just don't know if it's exciting, like where people get, like you said, you know, when Stenson and Mickelson won at it, that's exciting, and people get excited about golf. I don't know if, I'm fairly certain that doesn't fit in that realm.
No, I mean, you know, we have to think about golf and its future, you know, and whether we like it or not, whether we believe that all the excuses people say that they have for not playing golf, it doesn't matter whether they're right or whether they're wrong. We still have to change everyone's mind in order to get these people to continue playing golf. You know, we may have 25 million golfers now, but, you know, 10 years from now, it's going to be 20. And then, you know, it's keep going down and down and down. And we've got to find ways in the USGA and the PGA of America. We have to change rules. We have to change ways we're doing things. We've got to get kids into the game. And not just kids from the clubs, you know, where, you know, they have the programs. We've got to get the average kid, you know, from middle America that's willing to go out there. And we're not doing that. I mean, golf is going to turn into a game of the elite again. And it just pisses me off that no one seems to be doing anything about it.
Let's talk about the elephant in the room. Phil, with
you're talking about my gut.
I mean, what do you make of it? Just from a player standpoint, you watch it. I've seen the replay. I don't say anything. What do you think?
You know, the way I look at it is, Phil's Phil, and he had a meltdown. And instead of just saying, you know what, I screwed up and I'm going to leave, you know, he doubled down and comes up with this bogus reason. And it's like, I don't get it. I mean, I know, I've always said forever that the one common denominator that all the great golfers have is their egos are off the chart. And he just refused to accept that he was going to tell somebody he had a meltdown. And, you know, this was his opportunity, he thought. Think about it. When was the last time Phil Mickelson only missed two fairways and 36 holes at a U.S. Open?
Yeah. His Achilles heel was surpassed, right? Like, this is where, this was it, man.
He knew this was a great chance. And then comes that day, Saturday, and, he starts playing poorly. And it's like you have just been, you're devastated. You're in shock. You realize you're one of your best opportunities in the next 3 or 4 years is gone to quote, finish the Grand Slam. And he just had a meltdown, but one thing I haven't heard anyone mention about is, and I guess only the psychologists or the experts in the world, you can't tell me that in 2 seconds, Phil put rule 14.5 in his head and decided to give himself that 2-shot penalty. Think about it. I mean, we're sitting here talking and I couldn't even think about 14.5 and remember the rule properly. And you're telling me he had the wherewithal while he's running?
I find it, my opinion is it's hard. I think it's convenient for him to say this is what happened. I building the frustration of what happened, I highly doubt, unless he's just an absolute savant. But it's not even the right ruling, right? You would have just taken the unplayable.
Right. So,
everything
he says is just, but that's Phil. Phil can't, when Phil has his moments, it's not to, look back at, those occasional moments where he, and I don't remember the year, when Watson was the captain when they were over.
Ryder Cup.
Yeah, the Ryder Cup. And he came out and just lambasted. And that was all frustration why in God's name, the captain has nothing to do with how you play golf. I don't care if he put his arch enemies as teammates. You're playing in the Ryder Cup. Those players have failed miserably at the Ryder Cup. Don't blame it. And this, occasionally Phil has these moments. Phil's been great for golf. We all have our meltdowns. So why can't he just say, oh, boy, that was a meltdown of meltdowns?
I'm assuming you've had one, right? Like it's had to have happened to you where you've gotten so pissed.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean,
eject button kind of happens, right? I mean, it can get to that point of boiling over when you're trying so hard and it's just not working that that's the end result, right?
Something you want so bad and you just keep coming so close. I mean, think of how often, 6 runner-ups. It's the last leg of the slam. And he's a big history buff. He cares about legacy and where he's going to be and on the pole, so to speak, of great golfers. And for him, it's a big deal. And I just think it's a shame. And I hope he doesn't lose any fans for it. If he wants to double down and say, what he did, that whatever, I don't think anyone in America really believes it. So, if that's what he needs to say to justify it, then so be it. But it's a shame, but he's done too much for golf and he's too good with fans to let's rip him apart for it.
Let's talk about defending titles from a PGA Tour player's perspective. You've done it. You've won multiple times in the PGA Tour. Is there a different mindset for defending? Obviously you guys want to win, but is it a different level of wanting to win and a pride in trying to defend it? When you were out there, playing, did you have a different approach when it's an event defend?
The best thing about being a defending champion is that you have really good vibes. you know, I mean, you know, in the U.S. Open's much different, and this is why it's done so rarely, is that, you know, the U.S. Open, you're going to different courses, so it's not like you can say, you know, oh, I love this golf course. You know, look at Tiger Woods and how often he's won at Torrey Pines or, you know, in Akron. And, you know, it just sometimes you have those vibes on a course, and you could be going playing mediocre, and all of a sudden you show up and you start playing better just because of the vibes. You know, everyone who plays golf knows it's all about how your inner brain's. You know, if you feel good over the ball, you do better. I mean, it doesn't matter what level. And this is what I always try to stress to amateurs. I said, pros have these same feelings that it's just harder to recognize for us because the pros are so good. You can't tell, you know, a mishit shot was based on our head going haywire before we hit the shot. And, you know, to do it and, you know, in a U.S. Open, it's just like, wow. I mean, that's, you know, think about it. You know, Curtis was the last guy that did it, and then Brooks comes in and does it, and it just, you know, it's impressive. There's no other way around it.
What's your thoughts on Brooks Koepka? You brought up a little bit earlier of, you know, and he says he's underperformed for his talent. 3 wins, but now 2 majors. Do you see that, you know, next 10 years you're talking potentially a 15, 20-win guy with 3 or 4 majors? Obviously, he has the talent, but how do you assess his game?
Well, therein lies the unknown factor of everyone is what's inside. You know, how driven is he? You know, obviously in today's world, you know, financially you're set after a couple of years now. So, you know, money's not an issue. So that's actually sometimes a detriment because now it's pure yourself. How focused are you? Are you driven? Do you want to surpass anybody, say in the modern, you know, do you want to get to that 7 or 8 majors or, you know, potentially you could be, you know, even more, but I don't know. I mean, you know, Brooks is so quiet and reserved. It's hard to tell how driven he is. So it's, you know, there's some players you can tell, Tiger, Phil, you know, VJ, they were driven, you know, they wanted it, but I don't know. I think Jordan's driven, you know, he wants it. You know, that's the unknown. You know, does something happen talent wise? Good Lord. Of course he's got, you know, you can't win, you know, 2 US Opens. He's got the mindset and not have the skills to do it. So it's just a question of, you know, he's only, what is it, 27?
Yeah, 27.
And, you know, so, I mean, he's got a good 15 years left. So, as weird as this sounds, it's almost like if he wants it, it's probably doable. You know, now, they also have a problem in that there's also 10 guys that are also in that same age that are also great. I mean, you know, the tour is in great position in that respect. You know, normally there's, you know, you have the, you know, the Jack, and then 10 years later, there's a Watson and, you know, a Trevino. There's always been some gaps where, you know, except for maybe my era where, you know, there's so many guys close to each other. Right now, there's so many guys, you know, whether, you know, you got Rory and Justin and Johnson and, you know, Spieth and, you know, Day and, you know, there's tons of them. I'm obviously missing a bunch, but I honestly think you've got 10 guys that can just, for the next 15 years, are going to be beating on each other's heads.
Well, and that brings me to something I know that you highlighted your career and enjoyed playing in so much, Ryder Cup. And the American team is starting to look better and better. I mean, you just look at that leaderboard. I mean, obviously, Tommy Fleetwood played great, but you got, I mean, Patrick Reed is now showing up at majors. And you just sort of look down that chart of depth. I think the American team is going to, you know, is going to be as strong as it's ever been going into Europe, and there's no guarantee with that, but like your opinion on that. And then from what you've seen out of Tiger at this point, if you had to make you were the captain and you had to make a pick and you didn't qualify in points, would you put him on the team at this point or would you not?
Well, I'll go to the Tiger first. I think because he's become well-liked with the players, you know, serving as the vice captain and all that the last few years, I think it's a lock. I personally not so sure I would do it. You know, I just go back and I look at something, you know, the numbers are the numbers. When Tiger and Phil were, they just, we didn't win a whole lot. And I don't know if, you know, not being inside the, quote, players' rooms or the players, you know, what was the reason? But all I can tell you was that it was, it's crazy that we, what we, I mean, we went like seven Ryder Cups without winning one. I mean, but I think he's a lock. Unless, you know, unless for some reason he starts playing poorly, you know, maybe they'll use that. But, you know, I mean, Furyk is a good friend, and, you know, I just think you're crazy. I mean, he's still Tiger Woods. I mean, there's no other way around that. And, you know, the strength of the team is phenomenal. I mean, like we were just saying, it's, they're so deep now, and I wasn't a big fan of that. I forgot what they've since named it. You know, when all these guys got together and we're going to fix what's wrong with the Ryder Cup baloney.
Yeah, their committee, you know, thing.
Phil and their, and all the egos.
Yeah.
It's, you know, just go out and relax and like the Europe. That's what the Europeans do better. They relax and have fun. And again, everyone who plays golf, the harder you try in this game, you're done. If you cross that line of trying too hard, you're a fried egg. And that's what we have done in the Ryder Cup. And they put so much pressure on each other that it just becomes, you know, an avalanche. Now, you know, they're going to France. I know nothing about the golf course, so I don't know who it might favor, who it doesn't. But, you know, the Europeans also have some pretty good players, you know, and they have a habit of, they'll keep their so-called weak links out, which I'm personally not a fan of, but they will. So, you know, on paper, we are clearly the better team, but it's not like it's a football team where the better team usually is going to win, or, you know, a basketball, or, you know, this is golf. You know, it's a fine line between, you know, you could literally take the third next best team in America and they could beat the best team. There's that fine line in 1 week of match play. So you'll never convince me. It's about relaxing and having fun. And that's what Europe has always done. Go have some, you know, go have the beers, enjoy yourself and laugh and, you know, ask a person after he shanks one or two, what he feels like on the third shot. You're petrified. And this is basically what America's been for the last 20 years with the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, and I still think it's going to be close, right? Because, like I said, you still have Tyrrell Hatton was up there. I mean, the European team is still going to be able to put, like you said, even if it's eight guys. It's going to be competitive, right? I mean, just think Rose, Stenson. I mean, I could name eight guys, and I think you could flip a coin probably on those eight against eight. It's that bottom half, but do they leave them out and, you know, ascendantly leave them out? But they're not as exposed as the other guys, and you play those hot teams. And it's always in Europe, right? They always seem to have a little bit of an advantage over there. And I'm sure the captains will, you know, they'll do the home course advantage like we did on, you know, at Hazeltine and whatnot for our guys, of looking at the stats now that everybody has and set the golf course up for the Europeans. So
right. It's
probably going to be tight, but going into it, it looks really good.
Yeah, I actually think it should be the other way, and I don't mean to interrupt, but, well, I'm going to anyway, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, that's all right.
Is, you know, when it's in America, the American captain gets to decide, you know, what he wants, you know, the rough, the speed, the greens, the pins, and all that kind of stuff. And I think it should be the other way around. I think the Europeans should have the ability when it's in America, and the American captain should have the ability when it's in over in Europe, as to offset, if there is any advantage to doing all that, you know, because of the home field advantage thing. And I think it would be more interesting, and it would bring more questions from the media and the world as to, because no one ever even thinks about it when it's done, because they don't even, you know, it's like they don't even know that the American can decide, you know, what rough he wants on his course and the speed of the greens and the pins. But if it was the other way around, there would be all sorts of attention to it. And it's, I'll give you an example.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting point. That would be actually pretty fascinating because it would bring one more element of into it.
Like I said, the players win or lose the Ryder Cups. But if there's ever an opportunity where maybe the captain had a chance, I would blame Davis Love at Medina when they had that huge lead. he went for all tricky hard pins. And my belief was you should have just gone with moderate pins, because it's a lot harder to make birdies than it is to make bogeys from those nasty pins. And, you know, obviously we know what happened, but yeah. Other than that, I think it would be great talk, you know, sports talk, if you know, Furyk could decide how he wanted to set up the European course, and you know, Thomas Bjorn could set up the American course. Why not put more flavor into an event that's already the best of the best?
Wouldn't it be cool too if they did what they did with the President's Cup, where Captain Furyk would say Tiger Woods, and then the other captain could say Sergio Garcia?
I love that.
Wouldn't that be awesome to set that up that way?
Like, you could just make it. This is the male ego again. The male ego. The PGA refuses to take an idea and say, you know, that's a great idea, we're going to do that for the Ryder Cup. No, we're not doing
that. Everyone
in the world wants that.
Right. Like, how many times did Tiger play VJ when they were both in their heyday, right, at the President's Cup? Like, you knew both captains were waiting to be like, or let when Mike Weir beat Tiger at home in Canada when they had it up there, right? Like, that's what everyone wants to see, right? Like, Anna's home turf, Weir versus Woods, let's do it.
Yep.
Right?
Like,
see Tiger against Sergio right now? Like, that would be such a great Sunday match. I don't know why they don't do it that way, because I think it'd be better television.
Absolutely. I mean, why wouldn't you want? It just makes no sense, you know. Or you know, the other thing is that it might be the biggest crime in golf is, what's this half shot thing? You know, because of what the team did 2 years ago, we're giving the new team a half shot lead. So if we tie 14-14, you're considered the winner. That makes no sense to me. Have a playoff, period.
Pick a guy and have a playoff, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't care what you do, but when Tiger Woods was beating up on the world, you know, they didn't say to Tiger, oh, Tiger, you're so good, we're subtracting one shot from your score today, which is basically what they're doing at the Ryder Cup. I mean, it's insane that if you tie, it's decided by what happened 2 years ago.
Or the captains on Sunday at the start of the round have to put a name in the hat, right?
Yeah,
so
whatever.
You don't get to see how they play, like, and if it comes down to a three-hole aggregate playoff, right?
Whatever they want to do, they got to. It has
to
be
cool.
You know, I mean, they used to do it at the President's Cup. You remember the great Tiger Ernie Els battle in that playoff, that three-hole, and they got dark.
That was
phenomenal.
That was incredible. Yeah.
And they both said they never felt so much pressure.
Right.
I mean, that's exactly what you want. I mean, first of all, how often does a Ryder Cup or a President's Cup end in a tie? Once every 30 years, if you're lucky? So why not have that in there? I mean, I think it's sad. You know, if it's a tie, call it a tie. But don't sit there and give it to the dopes that won it 2 years ago.
My last question for you, Fox's coverage of golf and Azinger and Curtis and Shane Bacon and Steve Flesh, what's sort of I'm assuming you watched it, what's your take of how those guys are doing, and do you think they're starting to compete against the guys who have been doing golf broadcasts for a longer period now? Are they starting to find their rhythm and get their own groove?
They're clearly better than when they started at Chambers Bay, but they're still weak. There's no other way around it. I mean, Curtis knows what he's doing. He's good. Joe Buck, I think he's great, but I don't think he's he tries to create too much, you know, and golf's just golf. Just talk about it, you know, and Zing's okay. I mean, I don't think he's great, but he's okay. And, you know, they've got some work to do. I mean, there's no other way, you know. There's no other way around it. They don't work very well together at times. You know, they're talking around each other or over each other too often, and sometimes they're making points that are just absolutely idiotic. And my biggest beef about players who turn into the the broadcasting list, it's like they've forgotten they were players. It's like, you just if you had listened to another player say what you just said, you would have crucified him. It's like they've turned in. I don't get it. You know, it's, I don't know if they're trying to appease like the producer or whether they're being told they can't say X, Y, or Z, you know, without really knowing for sure whether they're put on a leash. You know, I mean, you know, like obviously I can't tell you how many people want me to do it. And I'm like, they're going to put me on a leash. You know, I mean, I just don't think that's golf. If you can't tell the truth, why do it? You know, and,
have you been because I think you'd be great at it. Like, I think your perspective would be, this is the reason why I called to have you on for talking about the U.S. Open. I think you'd be fascinating in a tower to talk about what you're seeing.
No one's approached me recently. I mean, NBC tried to get me about 15 years ago, and I just kind of decided my career wasn't over yet. Although it was, I just didn't realize it. my hardest thing would be, you know, doing all that kowtowing, you know, I mean, you know, like for instance, at the Shinnecock, remember, I don't know if you remember in the beginning how much they talked about how great Shinnecock was to the growth of golf in the beginning, and Shinnecock and the USGA yep. had this incredible relationship, you know, they were one of the first ones that held an open there, and then it was like 90 years before the USGA and Shinnecock got back together again. So what happened? Something had to have happened. You know, there had to have been a feud or a fight. Or, you know, Shinnecock is, like you said, it's too nice a golf course, especially back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, when the greens were not like they are now. We should have been playing Shinnecock every 10 years. So what happened between the USGA and Shinnecock? But is Fox afraid to report that because they signed this big deal with USGA? You know,
soon to have something to do with it, right? I mean, yeah. Well, you know, I mean, let me put it this way. If you were on a tower, it would be interesting. I'll say that. It would be an interesting telecast.
Well, maybe one of these days I'll make a guest appearance and go from there.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on with us today. Your perspective is, in your opinion, is always welcomed here. It's fantastic. And hopefully we can talk to you soon if maybe do a recap of Ryder Cup or another major. We'd love to have you on again. So thanks so much for your time today and your insights, Ken. I greatly appreciate it.
You got it, buddy. Have a good one.